From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear how a new position at the Milwaukee Art Museum aims to welcome more people of different backgrounds to the museum. Then we speak to a local photographer about what it was like to capture the historic protests in Milwaukee this summer.
These protests truly are peaceful. There's truly no doubt about that. And I march alongside these people with my camera in hand to show everyone that's staring at us and to show the police that we're not afraid to document what happens here.
We hear how Running Rebels has been improving the lives of Milwaukee youth for 40 years.
You know, you always see like what happens and what can't be prevented, but the one thing that you can't show is what was prevented. What didn't happen because somebody was connected to a positive mentor.
Plus our auto contributor, Mark Savage, talks about the rise of the crossover. Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Milwaukee Art Museum created a new position this summer following the historic protests over racial justice and diversity. The position was created to help make art relevant to more members of the community and engage more Milwaukeeans. Kintara Soufran is the first curator of community dialogue for the museum. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel last month about her connection to the museum and how she hopes to share that with a more diverse group of people.
So what exactly is a curator of community dialogue?
That is a fantastic question. So I would say that the formal job description is that the curator of community dialogue is going to be developing and implementing a comprehensive plan for adult community engagement, building the institution's capacity for making art relevant to our community, and delivering robust community programming. And all of that is tied to the Milwaukee Art Museum's strategic direction. I would say the way to whittle that down is to, and how I think about it, is that I'm really in the position where I'm thinking about, one, how can our programs be in alignment with our museum collection so that we can truly, truly, truly build an institution, build a collection, build programming initiatives that reflect and speak to a larger Milwaukee and Southeastern Wisconsin. So it's really, for me, about centering audience, centering our community's needs, and specifically speaking to Black and Latinx audiences. And I would say my time at the museum has taught me, and I experienced the ways in which the Milwaukee Art Museum is a beautiful building, but it doesn't always feel welcoming to people who are Black, brown, of color, low income, non-English speakers. So really thinking about how do we work to make the museum accessible to all?
Yeah. And why do you think this is something that Milwaukee needs right now? I know the position has been in the works for a long time, but why is it needed right now?
I think that this position really coalesces with this moment of extreme political turmoil that we're living in. So there's a few ways in which the Milwaukee Art Museum is not exceptional in that a lot of museums are reckoning with what does it mean to have been seen as elitist, historically white, classist, sometimes racist, right? And I think that the Milwaukee Art Museum, both on one hand, is on the cusp of really trying to redress those representations, right? To really figure out how to better reflect a Milwaukee population and how to really be accountable to a larger Milwaukee that is not white, not wealthy, not used to going to a museum. And for me, as the eternal optimist and advocate for the arts and the humanities, I really see the museum as a place that can inspire dialogue during these really difficult, intense political times. And even beyond that, I truly believe in the Milwaukee Art Museum as a place of inspiration, and that it can currently and in the future reflect the stories of people who look like me and with backgrounds like me. I didn't grow up going to art museums. My parents didn't grow up going to art museums. I think their first time being in art museums was when I was working at the Milwaukee Art Museum. So how to make it so that like my daughter, my cousins, my nephews, people who I encounter in Milwaukee all feel like the Milwaukee Art Museum is an invaluable part of the cultural fabric of the city.
And as a creator yourself, what does it feel like to be pursuing this passion of bringing more people into the museum and sharing that passion that you have for the work that you do?
I think that it is because I'm a creator and an art maker that I really understand how art can document people's experiences and how art can really, unlike any other platform, be a space of learning about others and telling others your story, broadly defined. And so because of that, I think that it makes me really excited to think about why the art museum could be relevant for people who, I mean, let's be real. I think coming to an art museum, there's a lot of obstacles that keep people from going, from costs to transportation to parking to figuring out, is there some sort of cultural etiquette for behaving in the museum? And I think because I'm aware of all those hurdles and all the structural and institutional barriers that could keep people from coming, but also because I'm a creator, I know that there is something to be gained from being in that space. There's something to be gained even from seeing one work of art that reflects you and where you are in this moment. There's like a refuge that the Milwaukee Art Museum can offer. And I think that's the thing that makes me really excited, is about how to connect those dots to people who see as going to the art museum as a luxury when I see it as a necessity, right? For just being able to survive and thrive in this moment.
And thinking about this moment in time that we're seeing, how has a summer of protests and activism influenced your approach to this new role or your plans for the role?
I am currently not in Milwaukee. I'm in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, so central Illinois, before I transition. And I have to say, when this job came out, my first thought was, oh, really? Like in a pandemic? Okay, cool. Yes, I'll take a risk and apply for a nonprofit job right now. But as I continue to think about it, and as I continue to witness what's been happening in Milwaukee, because my extended family is there. And as there was this moment in, I think it was June, where people were chalking outside of the Milwaukee Art Museum, and they were chalking on behalf of Black Lives Matters. And for me, everything about this political climate, everything about the call for racial justice and racial equity, makes me feel like museums matter now more than ever. And if they don't adapt, become accountable, become truly do the work of being inclusive spaces, then they're no longer relevant to our society. I feel like museums are public spaces where it's like public spaces for dialogue, disagreements, reconciliation, feel like they're slowly disappearing. And I think that's why works of art matter to me, because sometimes it's a lot easier to talk about racial justice when you're looking at a work of art that documents the experience of disenfranchised people, Black people in particular. Like that becomes a facilitator of conversations and experiences in a ways that I think humans, we just sometimes fail to listen to each other, but somehow it becomes a little bit easier when art is a mediator for that. So I would say that the experience of the protest just made me feel even more that there's more that the Milwaukee Art Museum could be doing, especially because the image of the Calatrava is one that I think has become synonymous with Milwaukee skyline. And for that, I think it becomes an unspoken responsibility for us to reflect our city.
How do you plan to reach out to the Black and Latinx community in Milwaukee?
That is Great question. I would say that it's probably communities, not communities. So there's like multiple Black and Latinx communities. That's not me correcting you. That's me wanting to use this platform to acknowledge that there's not one Black or Latinx experience. And I think that I want to be mindful of that when I enter into this work. I think that there are already amazing organizations that have been doing the work and that are trusted and have been both on the ground, writing grants, organizing with people, really a safe haven for connecting folks and gathering resources and distributing them. So for instance, You Black or Urban Underground, like Milwaukee's, the Black Holocaust Museum, like Walker's Point Center for the Arts, like there's already so many spaces that I know and love and connected with before I left the Milwaukee Art Museum for like an academic career. And so part of the work that I want to do is reach back out to those spaces and to reach out to other organizations who are already doing the work and to shut up, listen and see how I can what I can do to support their initiatives and if and how they'd be interested in partnering up with me. So it's a lot of the work that I really love, which is connecting to organizations that are already doing the work to ensure that there's a better Milwaukee tomorrow and for the future to come.
I think it's a great point you make about there being multiple communities and different experiences, and that you want to be mindful of that while moving into this new role and just having an awareness of the work that other people are doing and the partnerships that you want to cultivate when you move into the new role. So what is your vision for this new position? How do you see it?
So for me, I see this role, again, it's part program planning, part developing community partnerships, part getting to curate exhibitions, all this like fun stuff on paper. But for me, I see this role as fundamentally connected to community building. So on the one hand, I think it's what we've talked about before, it's sort of reaching out into greater Milwaukee and connecting and building partnerships, like sustainable partnerships, not just one-off events with organizations, right? But on the other hand, I think that there's that internal work that needs to happen in the Milwaukee Art Museum as well. So it's not just always this outward facing, doing this stuff to bring audiences in. I think in order to speak to some of the issues that we talked about, how does the museum become inclusive and inviting for all people? It means, all right, what training do we need to do, right? Like what training around racial equity, around racial bias, around classism, around disability and access, around ageism, right? So thinking that young people can't be in a museum by themselves. So I think that my focus is also thinking about internally, how do we build a community of MAM employees who have a similar vision and understanding of what it means to be supportive and welcoming of all of Milwaukee and all of Milwaukee zip codes. And I think that's also tied to the fact that we've been working offsite and virtually for a really long time. We don't necessarily have the same relationship that we would have if we were face to face. So how do we start to build trust and to feel like a community that's working together? And that means spending time and pausing. So not just filling our calendar with events just because we think that we have to, but really being intentional and mindful about how we build connections both inside the museum and externally. So as I get older, I feel like I'm more like the turtle instead of the hare and doing things slowly and thoughtfully, but really so that 10 years from now, I'm not recreating the wheel, right? That we've got a system that works and maybe needs to be tweaked from now and then. But that's one of the things I'm thinking about.
What are some of the things that you're really looking forward to or you're excited to get started on with this new position?
Connect. I didn't realize until COVID that I am an extrovert and I am like ready to be in touch with people. I think I've never... I still have lots of Milwaukee folks, like, who weekly I'm checking in with them, you know, like, they've become part of my chosen family and a really important part of my network. So I think I'm excited to grow that net of people and just to have conversations and learn about what's been happening and to see how the Milwaukee Art Museum of the post-COVID, post-2020 election can help our city to heal and to feel like there's more to this moment.
Kintara Sufran is the first curator of community dialogue for the Milwaukee Art Museum. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel in October about what she hopes to accomplish in the new position. Coming up next, we speak with a local photographer about what it was like to document the protests in Milwaukee this past summer. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The protests that took place over the summer have been compared to the civil rights protests of the 1960s. Huge crowds gathered in Milwaukee day after day to protest police brutality and call for racial justice. The historic marches were documented by many people taking videos and photographs on the ground. One of those photographers was Sam Ergani. He was out at the protests nearly every day capturing Milwaukee's role in the historic marches taking place around the country. To learn more about his experience documenting the protests, we spoke back in June. Ghani starts by explaining what motivated him to take his skills typically used for portraiture and music photography and apply them to capturing protests.
I felt as partially as a community leader and as an artist and as a person of color, it was my responsibility to go out there and document and bring visibility to what was happening. But more so in comparison to a show, the energy is the same, the passion is the same, the people that are there, it's all the same. And since through COVID, I haven't been able to do community work and I haven't been able to bring positivity to the community like I'm used to. And that's something that I want to do. It's something I really pride myself on doing. So being able to do that now, as terrible as these events that have led up to this have been, I just feel it's my responsibility. It's truly my duty to be out there and bring visibility to who we are and what we're trying to accomplish as a greater community.
And what is that image that you want to share with people, specifically those who don't live in Milwaukee? As outside viewers are looking at protests happening around the country, what is it about Milwaukee that you wanted to capture?
Well, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. And I think if we're not bringing visibility to these peaceful protests and the message that we're trying to send, then I feel like we're just entirely missing the mark as a community here in Milwaukee. All these people that are in these streets they're all different types of artists. They're all different types of entrepreneurs. There are kids out there and we're trying to lead a better generation for these kids. And these protests truly are peaceful. There's truly no doubt about that. And I march alongside these people with my camera in hand to show everyone that's staring at us and to show the police that we're not afraid to document what happens here because we have no ill intention. We're not the ones who have guns.
And in an age where everyone is out in the protests with their cell phones, everyone has the ability to capture a moment. But what do you think makes a good shot?
In times like these, I think quality. And I think cell phones, the best camera is always going to be the camera that you have on you. But if we can make sure that some of these injustices that are happening at these peaceful protests are documented in high quality, then there's no debate to what's happening or what had happened at that event. There's no UFO quality of what's happening. There's no room for speculation. And I think it's our duty as photographers and videographers to document and bring visibility. It's also our duty to protect the identity of the protesters. And I found myself really struggling on that line. And I've been having a hard time finding what to post and how to keep our community energized moving forward. But I think those lines will start to define themselves as we continue moving forward as a community, as we continue building rules for ourselves that are all inclusive and that are very protecting, not only of ourselves, but people on the other side as well.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there is a growing movement that calls for journalists and citizens to blur or not show protesters' faces. And even though Milwaukee's protests have been peaceful, obviously going in when the protests initially started, as things continue, what are you going to try to do or keep in mind or strategically set up shots? Like, have you decided that you're going to try and have no people's faces on there? And granted, like, a lot of protesters are wearing masks as well. So I'm curious how you feel in that debate, and you're immersing yourself in these protests also.
I've been doing my best to just take pictures of the backs of people's heads and their signs. And the only pictures of faces I've been trying to get are of the protest leaders and our community leaders who are happy and willing to share who they are and what they stand for. I've been sitting on hundreds of photos over the last week from the first 2 days that I haven't posted or anything, because I'm fearful that I may be doing wrong to our community. And I think what these protests have done in comparison to different movements in the past, it's brought people from all walks of life together. And I think people are truly afraid of stepping out of that comfort zone and really trying to fight for something good when they haven't in the past. And any sort of level of comfort that we can bring to people, or any sort of protection that we can bring to these people, I think is most important. So if that means I'm shooting for nothing, that's fine. If that means I'm documenting just for myself until the right thing comes along, I think that's also fine. I think what's important is we're bringing people together and we're making them feel safe.
I know there, like you mentioned, there's hundreds of photographs that you took of protesters moving throughout the city of Milwaukee, but do any specific shots come to mind or stand out to you, either because of how they turned out or because of what was happening when you were able to capture that moment?
Yeah, I think on day one, I captured a woman who was being arrested when we protested on the highway just off of North Avenue. And there was another gentleman that I took a photo of, and he had a shirt that just said, "I can't breathe." And there is a crowd of people behind him. And I think those two photos they're of very different people, two very different people from different walks of life. But the unity that they both shared that same day was very important to me. And I think those two photos were very, very, they contrasted each other, but they sent the same message. And I think that was very important.
This is a historical moment, not just because of the protest, but it's also one that's happening in the midst of a pandemic. So when you're out shooting during the protests with masses of people gathering, you know, do you have concerns for your safety either due to COVID or the potential risk that protests like others around the country could potentially turn from being peaceful?
I do fear for my health, and I fear for my family's health, but at a certain point, we have to fight for what's right. My fear is maybe the big cats want us to all get sick, and this is just an easy way for us all to get over with COVID as fast as possible. But it's a lingering fear that kind of never goes away. It looms quite like debt does. But, you know, I'm handing out masks and gloves, and we're all hand sanitizing as best we can. And like I said, top of mind is keeping us all safe and making sure everyone feels safe and protected. And I can tell that we're all doing our part, but there is a large cloud of fear, I think, that surrounds all of us when we go to these protests. But what's stronger than our fear is our will to fight for change.
What was your main takeaway being a photographer, not just observing, but being a part of these protests? And what do you want people to feel when they look at your photos?
I think my main takeaway is that my main takeaway was that no journalist is safe any longer. The lines of how journalists were protected are no longer there, which means that journalists share the same right as the people in the protests do. Like, we're all there together. I hope that when people see my photos that they feel inspired to act, whether that's donate money or food, whether that's sharing information, whether that's coming to the protest if they can and they're able. I just hope it energizes the community, and it continues to energize the community, because if we have 200 days ahead of us, we all have a lot of work to do. And I just hope to be a part of that flagship to keep people energized, keep people safe, keep people feeling protected. and to keep people fighting for the right cause.
How did this experience impact you the first day you went out, and how do you continue to feel it impacting you as things continue?
I've been stewing on that thought for quite some time. And when I first started documenting the music scene, when I first saw an artist like Kellen Classic, I teared up, I cried because of how emotionally powerful his message was on stage. And when I saw Sister Strings for the first time, I cried because of the message that they were sending through their music and through who they were and what they stood for. And I felt the same about Nickel and Rose. And when I went to that first day of the George Floyd protests, I felt that same impact. I felt that rush of energy in my chest. I felt those tears and I felt that emotion. And I'm trying to hold on to that feeling so that when 10 more days pass and 10 more days pass, that I know that I'm still trying to do the right thing. And it hit me like a ton of bricks in the best way possible.
Well, I know your photos continue to do the same for others looking at them. So, Sam Argani, thank you for your work, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Yeah, this has been a dream come true. Thank you.
Sam Argani is a photographer and videographer in Milwaukee. We spoke about his work documenting the protests back in June. Coming up next, we learn how the Milwaukee organization Running Rebels has been helping out youth for 40 years. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For the last four decades, Running Rebels has been mentoring hundreds of Milwaukee youth. The organization works to prevent involvement in gangs, drugs, violence, and the juvenile justice system. Victor Barnett is the director and founder of Running Rebels, and Dawn Barnett is the co-executive director. Victor and Dawn spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about what the organization has accomplished since they started 40 years ago.
When you look back at all you've done, what are some of your biggest or proudest accomplishments?
For me, as the founder, some of the biggest accomplishments for me is when I see a young person that were a part of this organization when they were 12, 13 years old, and to now 10, 15 years later, to see the right choices that they've made in life, the decisions to be a productive, positive person to society, but then the bigger piece for them to have in their heart to give back and come back and do something to help somebody else. Those are the type of things that let me know and let us know that we've done it the right way and for the right reasons.
I'm most proud of the growth of the organization. I mean, going from, because Victor started it by himself, you know, 40 years ago. So to go from one person to over 100 people, and just the journey along the way, all of the ups and downs and the struggles, challenges, opportunities, and joys, you know, just being able to see that through for 40 years, that in itself, I believe, is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, Victor, did you ever think when you started this, I would be sitting here talking about the 40th anniversary of this organization and so full of all these stories and successes from the people you've helped?
Often a lot of people don't believe me when I say it, but the answer is yes. When I first started, I had such a beautiful group of young men that were a part of my basketball team at the time. We sat down and we talked about who they wanted to be. When they said they wanted to be the Running Rebels, I just saw them involved in the decisions, everything from the name after the college basketball team, Running Rebels, to the colors that they wanted their uniforms to be. It always involved young people. So that next year, those 50 went and told their friends, and then I got 100 young people standing out there. I just felt that the brotherhood that was formed, that beautiful group of first group of young men, I just felt they were gonna be successful. So Dale Williams being the first young man I ever worked with, and I was a part of the Air Force, and then he came back to coach for Running Rebels, and that whole giving back, I knew he was gonna be a good young man. Can you imagine every year having 50 to 100 young people that benefit from the organization as far as being a better person? I just kind of felt it would be only a matter of time before it spread it. And then now you got thousands of young people that were a part of this movement. And if we can align some of that with other people, it only could bring about good things.
Yeah, so tell me about some of these personalities that you all have met, people who have grown through your organization. What are some favorite memories of kids you've helped that you think of when you look back?
The gamut is from A to Z. You know, we got young people that have never been in trouble. They just needed to be around the right environment. So we have a gentleman, Kevon Looney, been with us since maybe fourth grade, who's now in the NBA. First round draft choice, which is a dream come true for anybody that chooses basketball as their career. Got two NBA championships. I mean, how special is that? And what was so special about him is when I got phone calls from NBA teams to ask me about him, and they just wanted to know his character. And for me to tell them how good a young man he was, the story is told when he signed to go to UCLA. Most people would say, I'm going to UCLA. I'm not going to tutor anymore and work with kids. He chose to continue tutoring kids, even though he was getting ready to go to UCLA college. So he was a special person that we knew having him around, he would be in the right place, but just him rubbing off on others and how important that was. And then from that, we could take somebody that was facing 20 years in jail. We got two young men that don't have no shame in saying their story, but they were facing years in jail and got assigned to their mentor and did everything right and became successful men. So one of them is an engineer to this day, graduating from Tuskegee. And another one, when we see how much he cares about his kids, oh, it's one of the most special feelings in the world. So Dawn, any more young people you could think of?
I have a young lady who, you know, at the time, I didn't think I was even getting through to her. And oftentimes in the work, you know, in the work that we do, there are young people who, you know, you pour into, and you're just not getting anything back. And I thought, well, you know, I just don't think it's landing on her. And I ended up running into her 10 years later. And she said, Miss Dawn, I just want to thank you so much because everything that you taught me, it helped me later in life. And I was just, that one interaction taught me so much about patience. It taught me about not making assumptions. And just, it was encouraging me to say, you know what, regardless of what I'm getting back in that moment, because you just never know what a young person is going. You don't know how things percolate. Things percolate differently, you know, for every person. So I, you know, that's something I often share with our staff who can get frustrated when they're not getting that immediate satisfaction of I'm helping somebody. I know I'm helping somebody. Sometimes we don't know that we're helping somebody, but this taught me to keep going, to keep putting, you know, and planting those seeds. And because you never know. And sometimes you might hear about it years later and sometimes you might not, but just remaining positive to know that we're making a difference.
Yeah, I would imagine it's so rewarding not only to see the potential that someone has, but then to see it realized maybe in ways you expected, maybe in ways you didn't, but also the challenge of having no idea, Dawn, like you were saying, if it's getting through, if it's happening, that has to be really rewarding to find out later. But I would think that would be such a challenge not to really know where things might go.
Yes, absolutely. You don't know, you know, and like you said, sometimes you're surprised and sometimes you're heartbroken. We're in this field that you can't save everybody and we lose people along the way. So it is, you know, for me, it's trying to hold on, you know, to those stories, those people who, you know, who give me that hope and can refuel me in those times when we're not successful.
I think at the end of the day, I think it's so important to be able to say, did we do everything we can do for that young person? And if the answer is yes, then all you can do is your best and hope that it connects now. But as Dawn stated, sometimes down the line, and sometimes it don't. There's a young man that was incarcerated and 20 years of his life, he was spent in jail. But he told me himself, because we keep in touch, that I was worried, did I do everything I could do to help him? He said, you did everything. I was the one that made those choices. And to hear him even talking like that now, Yes, it's too late because he's incarcerated, but it's sinking in often when we don't even know it.
Yeah, it sounds like you all are so connected to the long term and the past of this community. So thinking about the purpose of Running Rebels, how do you think you've accomplished what you set out to do?
Well, as a kid, I remember being in fourth grade, my saying was I was going to help change the world. Didn't know what that meant, but I was going to help change the world. So I think what we've done over these 40 years is poured into so many young people that have become successful adults, and they are continuing that work. I think we definitely set out to do that, and we've accomplished that we are trying to help make the world a better place because of the work we did and instilled in these people that are now continuing to do that work.
Yeah, it's creating generational change. You know, when you help change the trajectory of one person, just think about the generations that come after, directly after that one person, and how many people that ends up affecting. So when people say, hey, it's one person, one life at a time, that really does make an impact. So, you know, you always see like what happens and what can't be prevented, but the one thing that you can't show is what was prevented. What didn't happen because somebody was connected to a positive mentor, you know? So we just know in looking and seeing the beautiful families that are starting to rise up as, you know, in line of all of the young people that have been through our doors and just proud to see that. And just gives you more hope for the future.
Of course, that has to be an amazing feeling. How has this work changed you all?
Well, it's been a dream come true for me. People often talk about dreams and can they become true facts. I'm living my dream every day. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to instill in young people. So every day that I wake up and come to work, I'm living out my dream. So it's special to me and to be a part of even feeling like we've been blessed as an organization to be in the position that we're in and to be able to feel like we could be a part of the solution of helping turn things around in Milwaukee, help get things right in our city, and to think that we could be instrumental in working with others to do that, that's special. So it definitely is a good feeling for me.
I think this journey has made me wise. It's made me more patient. It has emphasized and strengthened my faith because there were times when I didn't know how we were going to do something or accomplish something, or money was tight and a new opportunity came that I just didn't think we'd be able to do. So to be able to have that perseverance, that faith, you know, that this is possible, and that if we're doing things for the right reasons and in the right way, that there's nothing that we can't accomplish. So it has definitely changed me as a person and brought me so much purpose and joy.
And you all talk about basketball is a central part of Running Rebels. Why is that? Why did you choose that outlet to connect with people?
Well, as I stated, most of what we do here is driven by the young people. We have a joke back in the day that if the young people then in 1980 used to go skating, if they had connected to skating, we'd have been the Rolling Rebels, we say. So basketball just so happened to be the strong passion of the majority of the young men that I worked with 40 years ago. So now, many years after that, we chose to do football because we had 15 young men that said they wanted to be involved in football. And that was that thing that would help draw them away from the negativity and bring them towards positivity. So we here look at our programs and the decisions about this agency are a lot youth driven in regards to what will work and help save lives and make our community a better place.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's kind of like it goes in phases depending on, for us, it's all about what is it that the young people are interested in. And you might have a group this year, a very strong group of people who are into spoken word, So we do something around spoken word, and it might be 2 years later, that's not it anymore for the young people. So it's all about being tuned into what that thing is that creates passion in that young person or the people that you have around, and doing it. So for us, I think our strength is in our flexibility, in our creativity, in our willingness to keep, you know, that ebb and flow to meet the needs of who the young people are as individuals in that moment.
Victor and Dodd Barnett are the directors of Running Rebels. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about the 40th anniversary of the organization, which they celebrated last month. We'll take one more break and then return with auto contributor Mark Savage. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Crossover vehicles have been steadily growing and taking over the auto market. Starting at just 4% of car sales in 2000, they reached about 40% of sales in 2018. The Honda CR-V, Toyota RAV4, and the Nissan Rogue are the three top sellers. And while we may be driving less right now, the demand for more crossovers likely won't slow down. Auto contributor Mark Savage joins me now to talk about what makes crossovers a popular choice. Mark Savage, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Glad to be back. Thanks.
So crossovers have been growing in the auto market. They started under 4% in 2000 and have reached nearly 40% in 2018. I'm not sure what the numbers are today, probably along the same lines. So why is the crossover market growing so rapidly?
Well, I think you're right. It's probably a little more than 40% now. The market supposedly is growing about 9% a year. So whatever that adds up to over the last couple of years, and obviously 2020 is going to be an oddball year for everything. But, you know, I think it's a combination of things. It's the crossovers are more economical to run. They usually cost less than a big SUV or a pickup truck. And they're useful, and you're not paying the big price premium, and they actually look better than most of the, you know, big SUVs are pretty boxy and square.
Right. And there is now a slight difference. We have crossovers and compact crossovers. So can you explain those? And is it like a huge difference, or is it just kind of subtle in nature?
Well, I think the crossovers kind of started out as a car-based vehicle, and they still are. It's just that most of them started out as kind of a midsize. So you're looking at something that maybe was based like a RAV4 or something like that on a Camry chassis. And now they're just trying to make them a little smaller and a little more, I think, fuel efficient is part of it, and to lower the cost, because, you know, most cars are and crossovers have been in that $35,000 to $37,000 range. And some of the new ones that they've introduced in the last couple of years are both smaller, a little lower horsepower, and are now down into that $20,000 to $30,000 range. So it makes it a broader audience, at least, that can get it, and probably ends up being a second car for a lot of families too.
So do you think that cost component is the main reason that the compact crossover, does it fill a significant consumer gap?
Yeah, I think that's what we're seeing is that part of the market used to be small cars, and the small cars are not as useful as a small crossover because they're a little boxier, depending on, you know, the styling of that particular one. So this fills that niche that maybe you used to buy a Honda Civic, and now of course they've grown to be larger, and you're looking for something that's small that maybe is a second car, might be for a kid going off to college or even still in high school. Or just something to back you up that, you know, you've got a family car and you need something else that you can use on the weekends to run people around.
So you mentioned it's perhaps taking the place of a normal car for families. Does the fuel economy of a crossroad significantly differ from those?
Well, they're not dramatically different. And that's what's good about them, is that some of them are very similar in gas consumption, maybe a little bit off, you know, maybe 1 mile per gallon or something like that. But in the meantime, you've got, I think they said the industry average was like 1.5 times as much cargo room in the vehicle. So, you know, I might be able to throw in you know, more soccer gear in the back, or take it to, you know, the Home Depots of the world and get pick up stuff from the utility places like that and pick up stuff to bring home for gardening or working around the house and so forth. So I just think that as cars and sedans and coupes have kind of at least decreased in popularity, it was natural that then something like this was going to fill the niche, because the crossovers on the other end of the scale had already been growing and moving ahead.
Well, and I think one niche they're also filling in kind of a fun way is the style and the look of these cars.
Right. And I think being a guy that has always liked hatchbacks because they had a more of a fastback look to them, I think that crossovers offer that. And, you know, some are boxy, but some of them are not. I guess what I think of that came out this year is the Mazda CX-30, which is just the cutest thing. I think that one of the cutest things that's out there. I mean, it looks like they took, you know, a Mazda 3 hatchback and jacked it up and put it just a little bit higher with a little bigger wheels and so forth. And, you know, that's not a bad thing to have something that's a little sporty looking, that's still fun to drive. And it actually drives very much like a car because it's based on a car. And I think, you know, the manufacturers have just tried to make these look more attractive, and it's not just another, you know, box on wheels.
Well, and on the note of box on wheels, you said it's truly based on a car. So even though it's smaller with smaller wheels and you may be sitting lower, this doesn't necessarily translate to a rougher drive?
Not necessarily. And the drive and the ride, and it usually depends on the wheelbase. And my kind of standard is, I think you want about 106 inch wheelbase to get yourself a really good ride, or at least a decent ride on our crater-like roads that we have in Wisconsin. But some of these are a little smaller than that, maybe 103, 104 inch wheelbase, and a couple are even smaller yet than that. But they have worked much harder, I think, to make these more manageable and smoother so that you don't feel like you're driving a truck, which I think that's one of the things that wasn't attractive about the SUVs. You know, a lot of people thought that they looked sporty and tough and, I guess, manly in some way, but they rode like trucks. And so you bounced over every bump in the road and so forth. These are much, much smoother and much nicer riding. And if they are a little jiggly, they're not a lot jiggly. So that's always a good thing.
Not a lot jiggly. That's
yeah, not a lot jiggly.
Next head title for your next review.
And that you know, that's a scientific term that I like to use. Yes.
So we have the cost, styling, ease of drive, ease of use, and the economy of it. What newer crossovers have been introduced to the market? You know, what have you taken for a spin recently? You mentioned the Mazda. Are there any other top contenders, you think?
I should mention that, you know, when you're thinking of these kind of crossovers, the Toyota RAV4, Honda CR-V, and the Nissan Rogue are the three top sellers in this kind of category to begin with. But this year alone, the CR-V was redone, and I drove both the gas and the hybrid powered ones. And personally, I like the hybrid one better because I'm getting much better gas mileage. I got 43, almost 44 miles per gallon, and with a gas powered one only, I got about 28. So you're getting a more economy that way, and you pay just a teeny bit more. It's not like you're paying $3,000 and $4,000 and $5,000 anymore for hybrids extra, but that's nice. And the hybrid has 212 horsepower, and you think for a small or compact crossover, that's really oodles. Another one that I really liked was the Kia Seltos, which I think is a great sounding name anyway. It's something different. Mine was a star bright yellow, which was just almost like, I called it electric mustard because it was so bright. But that one's both cute. It has two-tone paint jobs, so you could have a black roof with it or something, so it makes it stand out a little bit more. And one of the nice things about it, and not all crossovers have all-wheel drive, but that one comes with all-wheel drive, and that was fully loaded. It was under $30,000. And you think it had a roomy enough interior that you could easily put a family of four in there and go pretty much anywhere. So I like that one real well. I know Hyundai has had the Kona out in the past, and this year it came out with the Venue, which now, if you like boxy styling, that kind of goes back that way. It looks a little more Jeep-like to me anyway. And that one starts, and I know this is hard to believe, at under $19,000. So like $18,500. and that's with a manual transmission, and about almost just under 20,000 for one with an automatic transmission. And again, doesn't have a lot of horsepower. It has 121 horses, which I know compared to, you know, most of these are 150, 160, 170. May not sound like a lot, but so many of the cars these days now have a sport mode that you can punch a button or turn a little dial. And what it does is it holds the lower gears longer, and so it gives you more oomph, more power off the line, so that if you're, you know, sitting at a stoplight, all that, you know, the guy behind you in the big F-150 isn't going to crush you because you're poking along. You can actually punch that and get going, and then you can go right back into the more economical mode. Then I know a couple things that are just coming out. The Subaru, of course, has had the Outback for ages, and they've had a Crosstrek before, but they have a new entry-level kind of crossover, the Crosstrek, that's coming out very shortly. That I think that everybody's going to like. I haven't been able to drive one yet, but I'm assuming that we'll get one this fall sometime. And then Toyota, kind of pushing the envelope a little bit, is going reintroducing its Venza, which came out, I think it was 2008 originally, then it went away. But it's going to be a highly styled, kind of a compact, a little bit bigger crossover, back more into the mid-level. But I think it's going to be more luxurious, kind of along the lines of a Camry, which is, it started out kind of as a Camry wagon. It was kind of the thought, I think, at the time. So all those are, you know, coming out new. And obviously on the luxury end of things, there's always something coming out. Currently, there's, this last year I drove a Lexus UX250H, which means, the H means hybrid. And again, that one got about 44 miles per gallon, but now you're talking considerably more money. You're talking in the $40,000 range, but it is more luxurious. BMW, Mercedes, everybody's got something that they offer at this point. Also had a Volvo XC40, which is another new little one, and that one handled great and rode very nice. So there's another, you know, if you're looking for something a little more luxurious, that certainly would be one of the possibilities.
So crossovers are not just, you know, mid-level economic options. There are luxury ones as well. I never thought of that, honestly.
Yeah, there are luxury ones, you know, but again, now you're talking, probably most of the time you're talking 38 to 45,000 for starting price. And like anything else, if you load it up with everything, you might hit 50 grand or so. To some of us, that still seems like a lot of money, but so I'm partial to the Mazdas and Subarus and Toyotas of the world that come in a little less than that.
Definitely. Well, there's certainly a range of choices for people to choose from when it comes to crossovers.
Right. And they'll be economical, at least to drive at that point.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Mark Savage is Lake Effect's auto contributor, and you can find all of our past segments with him at WUWM.com, along with his weekly column. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered, coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.